Welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our guest today is an old friend of mine, William Bloom, and Bill is an American author, historian, and critic of United States foreign policy. He studied accounting in college, and later he had a low-level computer-related position at the United States Department of State in the mid-1960s. Initially an anti-communist with dreams of becoming a Foreign Service officer, he says he became disillusioned by the Vietnam War. William Bloom, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you again. Before we get into your latest anti-empire report that I just received in my email inbox yesterday, I want to give my listeners a little bit of a background on you and want to talk about, first of all, I want you to tell us about 2006 when Osama bin Laden recommended one of your books.
Yeah, that was in January of 06. He, in one of his recorded announcements, he mentioned my book, Rogue State. He said Americans should read the book if they want to understand why the U.S. is attacked by terrorists or so-called terrorists. And that made me into an instant celebrity. I was on many of the TV shows, including it's been a while. On MSNBC and on CNN and a bunch of others.
Uh-huh.
Well, what was very common is that the people who interviewed me, they wanted me to say that I resented being endorsed by.
Right.
Bin Laden. They wanted me to reject this endorsement, and I refused to do so because I had no reason to feel that way. If he
right.
if he shared my views about U.S. foreign policy, then he's on my side. Why should I renounce him? Mm-hmm. The issue at hand was simply U.S. foreign policy, and we shared that view, at least insofar as the Middle East is concerned. So I refused to accede to the wishes of these radio or TV MCs who were pushing me to say I rejected the support.
How did that do for your book sales?
I estimate I sold about 20,000 copies of the book because of that. But oddly enough, and unfortunately enough, the endorsement may have cost me money, because I was banned from campuses. I couldn't get a speaking engagement for years, and I had been getting between 5 and 10 every year. And the money I lost on that far exceeds the money I made by the extra sales of my book.
Well, you've been doing this for a long, long time. You didn't just start your, opposition to U.S. empire with the Bush administration. And tell us about, since you've been doing this for quite a while, I believe I read that you were pro-U.S. foreign policy until really Vietnam, and that made you change your view, and you became very anti-empire, anti-U.S. foreign policy. But
yeah,
do you see any change between administrations, between Democrat, Republican administrations, since you've been doing this in your experience?
Not on foreign policy. The foreign policy of Obama and George W. Bush, for example, is indistinguishable. There's no difference. I was a good, loyal supporter of U.S. foreign policy until the mid-60s. In fact, I was working at the State Department planning on becoming a Foreign Service officer so I could join the great anti-communist crusade. But then this thing called Vietnam came along and changed my mind completely and my life.
What did you think when you were in Chile reporting on Allende's socialist experiment before he was overthrown by the CIA?
What did I think about what, do you mean?
About Allende's socialist experiment, since you were, you know, you came from an anti-communist perspective.
Yeah, but that was after
right.
Version.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down there as a sympathizer. I was probably more revolutionary than Allende was, but I supported him, and it was quite a very sad thing for me and the countless other Americans who went to Chile at that time. When the coup took place, I was not there. I'd been there for 8 months, but I had left before the coup. But we all expected it, so I was not shocked, but I was very sad.
Why do you think that President Chavez, why do you think he's been able to stay in power for so long? I know that we did try to overthrow him once, the U.S., and we spend a lot of money through especially USAID and National Endowment for Democracy in trying to, defeat him electorally, but he's been able to stay in power now for over a dozen years.
Yeah, I think leaders all over the world, or certainly progressive leaders all over the world, have learned their lessons. As everyone knows, that when a leader comes out against U.S. foreign policy, he's opening himself up to a possible coup. That's even the kids know that. So they are much more cautious. They take precautions. And they will not allow certain people to be the U.S. ambassador or. They know the tricks the U.S. plays, and they watch their own government employees and to see who associates with the U.S. embassy in a certain manner and so on. I mean, there's many things they can watch and observe, and they watch organizations like you mentioned, the National Endowment for Democracy, which was formed specifically to be a front for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all over the world promoting democracy, as they call it, and I call it the opposite. It's undermining democracy. So Chavez and people like him know very well to keep their eye on the NED.
Well, let's go tie this into what is happening and what recently happened in Libya. In your latest anti-empire report, you say that there's some kind of worldwide eternal belief that American foreign policy has a good side that can be appealed to. And you associate it with Gaddafi, with the Zapatistas, with President Chavez.
Yeah, and a bunch of others. I think I give 8 examples of leaders, progressive leaders, who, when they were threatened by Washington, when they knew that a coup was looming, they appealed to Washington, even in person, like Cherry Jagan of British Guiana. He was
right
at the White House with Kennedy. So they all held some hope or some faith in the idea that there's a good side to U.S. foreign policy, that one can appeal to that good side and prevent any action against their own government. But they all found out otherwise. The 8 examples I give, they were all overthrown by the U.S. government, despite their appeals. And the most interesting example is Ho Chi Minh of Vietnam. He was a great admirer of the U.S. and of the American Declaration of Independence. And he wrote many letters to President Truman and the State Department asking for their help in keeping France from reconquering and recolonizing Vietnam. Instead, the U.S. Joined France in the overthrow of Ho Chi Minh.
And recently, Gaddafi
he sent
also
a letter.
Appealed to Obama directly.
He spoke to him as a son of Africa, hoping that he would change the policy of NATO, which had already started to bomb Libya. And I think that's he was either being very naive or very desperate. I mean, if he could imagine for a moment that there was a difference between the U.S. and NATO, I mean, one has to be really out of it to hold that belief. NATO is the U.S. The U.S. is NATO. If the U.S. left NATO, NATO would not last more than a week. So,
and also what about the UN? I recently heard that the U.S. is pulling funding for UNESCO over some Palestinian issue.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a separate matter. That doesn't. The U.S. is not making a payment of $60 million, which was due to UNESCO this month or next month, because the UNESCO had some committee of UNESCO had recognized the statehood aspirations of the Palestinians. So we just are not going to pay them any money.
Do you think that the UN and NATO were actually set the rubber stamps for U.S. foreign policy, or do you think they've just transformed into that over the years?
Well, the UN is not quite the rubber stamp that NATO is. There's been a bias in the UN towards the West for ever since it was founded in the Cold War. Certainly, the UN had that bias, but there are many exceptions, and there are many separate organizations and committees of the UN. It's not just one body. I mean,
right.
Of NATO, there's one official foreign policy, and that's it. There's no variation. The UN has many sub agencies, and some of them have done very good. And all kinds of things that happen at the UN which can be beneficial. In my same issue of the Anti-Empire Report of yesterday, I show the past 20 years of the vote in the General Assembly condemning the U.S. embargo of Cuba.
Right.
20 years in a row, by overwhelming numbers, the General Assembly has condemned that embargo. So there are good sides to the UN.
Well, don't you think the General Assembly, of course, is far more humanitarian and bent than the actual Security Council?
Well, there's no veto power there of the U.S. or the U.K. That's a big difference. In the case of Libya, the bombing began because Russia and China, who also have a veto power, they abstained. I'm not entirely certain why they did that. It was very unfortunate. I think some people have suggested it's because they expect tit for tat. When they invade somebody, when they plan to invade, they expect the U.S. and the U.K. and France to abstain. Or support them in the future. I think that's probably one reason why they abstained. But still, it was very disappointing. Any pretense that Russia or China has to being independent of the West and being progressive took a body blow with that.
I'm really distraught over what happened in Libya and what's happening in Libya, because I'm one of the reasons for, just because it's just plain wrong, but one of the reasons that I'm so distraught over it is because there's no outrage. And Bill, I think that if Bush were president and Bush did the same exact thing, there'd be people out in the street. There'd be outrage over what just happened in Libya. What do you think about that?
There would be more than there is now, but I don't think it would be a large mass movement. Most Americans, even on the left, they are suckers for this thing called humanitarian intervention.
Uh-huh.
They've been brought out by that. The same thing happened exactly with Yugoslavia in 1999. NATO and the U.S. bombed Yugoslavia for 78 days in a row, and they called it humanitarian intervention. And that caused a big rift on the left. I had many arguments with other people on the left over this, and those rifts have still not healed. I still come across them. People are still mentioning what happened in 1999, and they'll be mentioning what happened in Libya in 2011 for a long time, I think. So the left is composed of many people who should know better, but it can be suckered into support by using the right terminology. And, of course, Gaddafi, along with all the good things he did for the people of Libya and for Africa, he was very, very tough and cruel to his own opposition. And so it was easier to make him the object of hatred than it was with Milosevic in 1999.
Well, that's what I get hit with all the time, because I go out speaking and I oppose this U.S. foreign policy the same now that I did when Bush was president. And a lot of people actually stand up and tell me, you know, Cindy, the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, it was wrong, but now don't you think we have to stay to protect the civilians and protect the women?
Yeah, but that was a lie, though. They were never in the
right.
Which was
so I always ask the people that ask me that if they believed the same thing was true when Bush was president, and they always say no. Oh no, of course not. You know, Bush was evil. Bush was stupid. But you know, now we believe it because you know there's a president that's not evil and not stupid.
Yeah, I'm afraid they're wrong. I'm afraid it's fine. Obama's foreign policy has been perhaps even worse than Bush's. Obama has waged war against six different countries. That's amazing. I mean, if he wasn't a Nobel Peace Laureate, it would be amazing. But given the fact that he won that prize,
mm-hmm.
He's waged war against six countries, and so you can call that evil, too. And I'm not sure he's any brighter than Bush. You know, they all say Bush stupid, Obama clever. The things that he has said, if they came out of the mouth of Bush, people would have no hesitation in laughing at them. For example, his refusal to prosecute or investigate Bush and Cheney for war crimes.
He says
we have to look forward, not backward. And I've written, imagine a prisoner standing before a judge in the court and saying, Your Honor, we have to look forward, not backward. I should not be charged with these crimes. You know,
right.
It would be laughable. And yet Obama has used this exact argument again and again in defense of Bush and Cheney. So I don't know if he's any brighter than Bush.
Yeah, he has instituted a program where he is able to sign execution orders for U.S. citizens without any of their due process. So he's definitely not looking forward, or actually even looking at any transparency for evidence in the case of, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki and his son and his son's friends.
Right. There have been a total of 4 Americans, I think, killed in Yemen in the past couple of months by U.S. missiles. And the Obama White House doesn't even make an attempt to defend them on any kind of legal or constitutional grounds, which is really an insult to the people here. I think even Bush would have come up with a better excuse than Obama has.
Well, you know, Obama actually doesn't really need to defend his policies because the people who should be opposing him have been neutralized during his administration. And, of course, the people who, you know, are natural opposition to him, the Republican right-wingers, they agree with those kind of policies.
Yeah, even if they have a hard time admitting that, if there had been a Republican in the White House the past 2.5 years who had done exactly what Obama has done in foreign policy, he would have full support of his party. But of course there are many people on the left who have abandoned Obama in the past couple of years because of his policy. So it's not quite as bleak as you make it sound. I don't think he'll be reelected. I mean, well, that would depend on who his opposition is. If the Republicans put up a halfway decent person against him, he'll lose. But I don't know if the Republicans have any halfway decent person.
Well, I don't really. I'm of the mind that it's not really the president. It's the system that drives the policy for sure. But what do you think about I think things are pretty bleak, Bill, but you know, I haven't been doing this kind of stuff nearly as long as you have, but it just seems since I've been hyper aware of everything in the last almost 8 years since my son was killed, it seems like things have just become far, far worse, and we do see some people waking up in the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy movements and, you know, things like that. But, of course, foreign policy isn't their primary focus. Their primary focus, of course, is domestic policy and jobs and the economy. Right. But I've been trying to tie in the fact of, you know, our wars and our military and our empire suck so much of our resources. That's why we're hurting so much at home. But what kind of energy do you see in that movement?
Well,
a lot of Democrats, of course, are trying to co-opt it to keep Obama in the White House in 2012.
Who did you say is trying to co-opt it?
A lot of Democrats are trying to co-opt it to keep Obama in the White House.
Oh, well, the people in the Occupy movements, they seem to be very conscious of the danger of co-optation.
Yes, they do.
That may be a barrier to that. I think the next step in their evolution may be they're extending their protest to include foreign policy. I hope that there are people who are going into these camps and trying to spread the word about U.S. foreign policy and how it ties in to a domestic policy to the corporations, how the corporations are the main beneficiaries of these wars, the defense corporations. That may be, I hope, the next step in the evolution of these young people who have a lot to learn, but they can learn. So let's see what happens. I'm impressed so far with their gains. I think if they had come out immediately with a list of demands, these are the things we want done or changed, that would have hurt them. I was annoyed that they didn't at first, but I think in hindsight, I think it was a good thing, because if they had come out with a list, a good list of progressive goals, they would have been immediately stamped and labeled as the left by the mass media, and the mass media would have not given them all the attention and the time that they have. So it's good that it was sort of a gradual build-up, and it was not sudden like that. It gave the mass media a chance to not be turned off and to actually investigate the phenomenon.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I want to give you an opportunity to give your website or email or whatever. But yesterday in Greece, and we know that Greece, the people of Greece have been very militant and committed to not allowing the policies of the Greek government all around their debt and their reliance on the IMF and the World Bank and the European markets to harm them, to harm the people of Greece, because it wasn't their fault that Greece got into this problem. And yesterday, I think because of these protests, their Prime Minister Papandreou and the Greek Assembly have said they're going to put, instead of deciding about these issues, they're going to put it into the democratic vote of the people of Greece. I think that was a big victory for the people who have been out in the streets for months and months and months in Greece.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I wonder how. Yeah, I agree. I wonder how it'll turn out. It's the banks are the main object of the European Union and their governments. They're protecting the financial community from suffering too much. They don't care about the masses of people. So it's very proper and appropriate to not accept the orders of the European Union, or take them at face value. They're to be suspected. So this vote, I wonder if the vote it passes, I wonder what will happen then.
Well, like you call them the prostitutes.
Yeah.
I was listening to the news, and the prostitutes were just in absolute shock and distress over the decision of the Greek government, because how dare any government put a decision like that that's going to hurt the banking system into the hands of the people?
Right. How dare they impose democracy?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was amazing to me, and like you said, It oftentimes the empire expands to protect wars and corporations. So it will be interesting to see how that vote goes and what the response to it will be.
I'm very curious. Well, when is the vote?
Well, William Bloom, we're out of time. Time goes by so fast for me. But can you tell my listeners your website or how they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, my website, they can read portions of each of my books on that site. It's killinghope.org.
And we'll also link it to my website and for the show. So, Bill, it was really nice to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
Cindy, you're great. Bye-bye.
That was my guest, William Bloom. Well, that's the show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. I hope it spurs you to research some of these issues on your own. It's so easy to do these days in the days of the Internet and instant access to information. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guest, William Bloom, and you for listening. My name's Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.